I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to run a test on that gun. My guess is it'll be a forensics match for the gun that killed Tyson Dibbs. And even if it's not, those hands that were just around your neck, they're going to be there again, I promise you. And next time, we're not going to be here to stop them. Where's the boy?
That's Anthony LaPaglia in a scene from his CBS series Without a Trace. He won a Golden Globe for his portrayal of an FBI agent heading the Missing Persons Division in the CBS series. He won an Emmy for his performance on Frasier as Daphne's drunken, obnoxious brother Simon. LaPaglia's movies include Lantana, The Guys, The House of Mirth, Company Man, and So I Married an Axe Murderer. Now he's starring in the new movie Winter Solstice as a single father raising two teenage sons. The family is having a hard time recovering from the loss of his wife. He's losing touch with his sons. The younger one, played by Mark Webber, is getting into trouble at school. The older son, played by Aaron Stanford, wants to leave home. In this scene, he breaks the news as his father is doing paperwork and his younger brother sits on the couch.
What do you mean you're moving out and getting your own place?
Actually, I'm leaving town. I'm gonna go to, Tampa, stay with Brian for a while, and then maybe get a place down there.
Why?
I don't know exactly.
You're leaving town and you don't have a reason.
No, I have reasons.
Well, what's your reason? Where do you think you're going?
It's between you two.
I want you to sit down over there, Pete. Pete, get back in here and sit down!
Hey, take it easy.
Why didn't you talk to me? Gabe? Why didn't you talk to me?
A scene from Winter Solstice, which also stars Allison Janney. I asked Anthony LaPaglia what drew him to the film.
The script was very sparsely written. So it was much more about, you couldn't lean on dialogue or words for performance. You had to really kind of use your emotional skill as an actor to get across whatever you wanted to get across.
Well, exactly. I mean, your character isn't very verbal, and the story takes place during a time of his life when he's feeling kind of helpless and paralyzed about either moving his life forward or helping his sons move their lives forward. So what are the difficulties of that kind of role, where it's really not in what you're saying, it's kind of in what you're thinking, which you can't telegraph?
Well, you have to, you know, it just means that instead of, you know, in a lot of film and television these days, you have a character telling you what he's about to do, and then you see them do it, and then they tell you what they did. So,
I've seen that TV show.
Yeah.
I've seen that movie, and, too.
Yeah, and there's a lot of that. Therefore, you just, you know, basically your narrative, your running commentary. And there's very few movies now that kind of trust that the audience doesn't need everything spelled out to them in so clearly and so simplistically. And I'm attracted to that kind of material. It's more difficult because you have to focus more. You have to really kind of be connected to the person that you're acting with. And it's really about more, it's more what happens between the lines than the actual lines. And often the lines themselves are irrelevant. It's the undercurrent of what's going on between the two characters that you have to build. And that makes it a more difficult job in terms of acting.
Your co-star in the movie is Allison Janney. Now, she's one of the stars of The West Wing. You star in the TV series Without a Trace. There was a period when it seemed like movies offered the great roles and TV was like the lesser storytelling. And TV used to threaten to ruin film careers. And now that's really changed. You know, there's some terrific dramas and comedies on TV. And a lot of actors make their career in television, and that boosts their movie careers. And I'm wondering if you feel you've seen the relationship of television and movies change in the lives of actors.
Oh, sure. When I started to do television was to admit defeat and admit that you were a second-rate actor that wasn't capable of doing movies. It was a very strong prejudice. It's interesting, too, because in England, there's no distinction. You do theater, you do TV, you do movies. You have to because that's how you make a living. They don't have a star system. Nobody gets paid $25 million a film. So you have to work, which in the end makes you a much more complete actor. Here, there was always a very strong stigma attached to if you were a TV actor, why would people pay money to go? If they could see you for free every week, why would they pay money to see you in a theater? That's changed to the degree where if you don't have a TV series, it's hard to get a movie career. It's done the complete turnaround.
Did you have any reservations about taking the leading role in Without a Trace?
No, none. For a multitude of reasons. By the time that role came to me, I was 43. I was just about to have, my wife and I were about to have our first child. I didn't want to go to Canada anymore. I didn't want to go to Prague anymore. I didn't want to travel to go and do films anymore. I also didn't want to work for scale anymore, no matter what film I did. Basically, since the advent of the $25 million actor, and I don't begrudge those people at all. It's like if you can make $25 million for doing a film, then God bless you, that's great. The problem is that the studio then turns around and cries poor for everyone else. And so other cast members, crew, they're all supposed to work for basically scale because they paid one person all this money. And quite frankly, I got sick of it. I got sick of being asked to be a supporting actor in a movie with someone who... Some of them were good, and some of them weren't so good. Some of them were just flavor of the year. And asked to work for basically scale. And for as much as I love acting and I treat it as a craft, it's still my occupation. And I still want to make a living out of it. And it just seemed unjust to me to have to be in a movie with somebody that was making $22 million, and I was supposed to work for a lot less than that. To put it this way, it's better to be number one on the call sheet on a TV show than number seven on a call sheet on a movie. And I also feel like that in today's climate, a lot of the more interesting stuff is being done on TV.
Mm-hmm.
I think Deadwood is a lot more interesting than almost every movie being made. I think that The Sopranos has definitely proved that television is better than most movies.
Didn't you almost get the part of Tony Soprano, or at least you were a contender for it?
I was actually sent the script and liked the script very much and committed to doing it. Then the people that we approached... David Chase and I approached to do it as a series. It was a network. I'm not going to get into naming names, but they passed on it. So then it kind of floated around, and I stayed attached to it for a while. And then it went to HBO. But by that time, I had gotten the chance to get View from the Bridge, Arthur Miller play, up on Broadway, which I've been working on for a while. And so that, together with the fact that over time, David Chase and I think our opinion on how the character, who the character was a little different.
What was your view?
My view was that he was an outsider and that hadn't been involved in the family business and therefore had a slightly more urbane quality to him. So he was more of a fish out of water. And David did not feel that way. David felt that he was, even though he had been out of the family business, and in the pilot he'd been out of the family business, and come back, and he was seeing a shrink. So I felt that he had, even though he was trying to hide the fact that he was seeing a shrink, he still had a kind of insight that was a little higher than the people around him. And as it turns out, I was wrong, and David Chase was right. In his interpretation of who the character should be was perfect, because James Gandolfini totally embodied that character.
Nevertheless, do you ever watch The Sopranos and think it could have been me?
No, I really don't. I don't envy that, you know. I don't, because I think James Gandolfini is a brilliant actor, and I think that over time he'll turn it into something else. But for a long time, he'll be known as Tony Soprano, and that's, you know, that's not meant as meant to be detrimental. It's just that he is so incredibly brilliant at that part. So I think that audiences have a hard time associating him with something else. And that's kind of the risk that you take. Whereas the character that I play in Without a Trace is a lot more generic and a lot more less defined.
Yeah, but that's like saying, isn't that like saying, I want to play a character that's more generic and less defined? I mean, that's not what you look for in a character.
If you're going to do 7 years on a television series,
yeah,
it's better.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Because at the end of it, you're not locked into, mm-hmm. I mean, I'll give you a perfect example. If you look at Seinfeld, for example, George Costanza. Mm-hmm. He's such an identifiable character that whenever you see Jason Alexander, who's a brilliant actor, do something else, it's hard to get past George Costanza. Whenever you see Michael Richards do something else, it's hard to see past Kramer, because they were brilliant, very defined and brilliant. And therefore, after that portion of your career is over, you then have to reconvince everybody that you're just not that person and there are other things you can do. So therefore, having a character that doesn't have... believe me, I thought it out. it was very carefully thought out, the decision to take Without a Trace, the reasons to take it, the reasons to play the part the way I play it. It was about longevity after the series is over.
My guest is Anthony LaPaglia. He stars in the new movie Winter Solstice and in the CBS Missing Persons series Without a Trace. He won an Emmy in 2002 for his guest starring role on the series Frasier as Daphne's drunk and obnoxious brother Simon. Here's a scene from an episode in which Simon is staying at Frasier's place and brings a woman with him.
Oh, Frasier, this is Loretta. Loretta... Well, you know who you are.
I'm sorry, miss, but we are not entertaining guests this evening. You'll have to leave.
Wait, you told me this was your place. You're probably not even the Duke of England.
Oh, yeah? Then why do I talk this way? Well, you're just a big contraceptive, aren't you?
You grew up in Australia. And
yes, I did, yeah.
How old were you when you came to the States?
22.
Okay, I've been listening as you speak for signs of an Australian accent, which I do occasionally hear, but on the whole, you sound pretty American. If I woke you up in the middle of the night and you just started speaking, would you have a more of an Australian accent?
No, this is pretty much my normal accent now. After 22 years at first I had to consciously do it just to get work. Because when I first came here 20-something years ago, Australians were not in vogue. They are now. But 20 years ago, if I went into an office to audition for a part and I used my normal accent, I would never get the role. And it took me a few auditions to figure it out. And then I started going in And basically what would happen is about the time I was first got here, Paul Hogan had kind of become a big thing because he had done a tourist ad for Australia. And it was the put another shrimp on the Barbie thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so Americans seemed to be completely enthralled by this this commercial. And every time I went in to meet someone and I said I was from Australia, there would be a 20-minute conversation about Paul Hogan and another shrimp on the Barbie and blah, blah, blah. And then I would have to audition. And after every audition, the person would say, I can hear your Australian accent. It's not going to work. And I used to think, oh, that is couldn't possibly be true because I had worked so hard on developing a credible American accent. And I realized that it was the 20-minute conversation about Paul Hogan that was killing me. So
that guy nearly ruined your career. It's not
yeah,
fair.
Yeah, he did. He did. And so one day I went into an audition, and the casting director said, where you're from? And I said, Brooklyn. And he went, great, let's read. I read the part, and I got it. And that was it.
So you never went into an audition with an Australian accent again?
Ever.
So how did you work on changing your accent? Like, what did you do?
I was very, I was 22 or 23 years old, and I was very broke, but I managed to get a... You know, New York was fantastic back in the 80s. It was what we used to call sidewalk shopping. And people would just throw stuff out on the sidewalk. And some of it was good. It worked. I got a TV that worked. I got a little couch. I furnished my entire apartment from the sidewalk. And I got a double cassette player that somebody had tossed. And then I got a copy of Dog Day Afternoon. And which was my favorite movie at the time, and I watched it all the time, and then I taped some of it, and so I would tape little fragments of it, and then I would on the other side I would play it, and then I would tape myself repeating the sentence on the tape player, and I would do that every day for about an hour, and then I would just go out into the world of New York. And I would just apply my American accent. And within 6 months, I had completely eradicated my Australian accent.
So you modeled your accent on Al Pacino?
I did. It's since kind of developed into its own thing. But in the beginning, it was Al.
Does he know that?
No.
That's really funny.
Although I meet him from time to time. And I just never told him that story.
Well, Anthony LaPaglia, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, it was my pleasure.
Anthony LaPaglia stars in the new movie Winter Solstice. You can also see him in the CBS series Without a Trace.